Okay, good morning, everybody. This is Bio231, and it is October 31st, and we're going to have a lecture on special senses today. And here's a sign-in sheet. So sign the sign-in sheet, please pass it around, bring it down to the front when you're done with it. Okay, so let's look at the schedule. Oh, that switch just broke. How about that? I can't get the lights on in the back. All right, so I'll have to leave some lights on in the front. All right, so let's look at the schedule. 31st, we're going to have a lecture on senses today, special senses. So we'll at least see what the difference is between general senses and special senses, and then we'll talk specifically about special senses. Then starting next week, Monday, we have a third lab practicum, okay? And then Wednesday, a third lab practicum, but no lecture exam. Then a week from Monday is a holiday, Veterans Day, so our third exam is going to be on a Wednesday, a week from next Wednesday. And the chapters are going to be fundamentals of the nervous system, central nervous system, peripheral nervous system, autonomic nervous system, special senses, and endocrine system. So we got just a couple more lectures, but not the heart. The heart won't be on it. And in lab, we're scheduled to do heart this week, but we're not going to do heart until we're done with the nervous system in lab as well. So we're going to do eyeballs and ears and brains in lab this week and not dissection. I couldn't fit any eyeball dissection in. We'll do that after the lab practicum next week. Okay, so anybody have any questions on the schedule so far? So far, so good? Okay. All right, so special senses. As opposed to general senses, let's see if I can get some pictures up here. Okay. All right, special senses, as opposed to general senses. A general sense is due to some kind of receptor that you have everywhere on your body. So if we present you with some kind of stimulus of a particular modality, you can sense that stimulus everywhere on your body. Like if I were to take an ice cube and put it on your earlobe, could you feel it? And if I put it on your kneecap, could you feel it? Or your elbow, or your big toe? All right, so temperature is what we call a general sense because you have temperature receptors all over your body. All right, that's not just in one special location. Same thing if I were to take a pin and I were to stick you with a pin on your fingertip or your belly button or your earlobe, right, or your kneecap, you could feel that painful stimulus. So pain receptors are everywhere on your body. That's a general sense. So that's the best way to think of a general sense is you have the ability to appreciate that energy all over your body, not just one or two locations. However, there are some senses. For instance, if I were to take a flashlight and shine it in your belly button, take that ice cube away, but put a flashlight by your belly button, could you see any light? No, you couldn't, right? So vision is a special sense because you can only appreciate light with your two eyes, just in a very specialized region of your body. The same thing for taste. If I put a sugar cube on your fingertip, could you taste it? Or on your belly button, or on your kneecap? Okay, or on your big toe, could you taste that sugar cube? No. Okay, you can only taste it when it's on your tongue. So again, taste is a special sense. And the same thing for smell. You can't smell anything unless there's an odorant molecule that gets in your nose. You can't smell with your fingertips. You can't smell with your belly button. All right, and the same thing for hearing. All right, if I put a loudspeaker on your kneecap, you won't be able to hear it. But if there's some kind of noise by your ear, then you will be able to hear it. So hearing is a special sense as well. So we've got, what have we got? Taste, we've got smell, we've got vision, hearing, and then there are two more having to do with equilibrium senses. Equilibrium senses allow you to understand how you're moving in space and in particular accelerating when you're changing velocity, not when you're going at a constant velocity, but when you're changing velocity. And there are different ways you can change velocity. One is in a straight line. We call that linear acceleration. So when you speed up going forwards or speed up going backwards or speed up going up or down, there's a part of the inner ear that can tell that. And then there's another equilibrium sense for angular acceleration. And that allows you to experience spinning and in all three dimensions, in all three planes. So you can tell if you're spinning head over heels, right to left, and that helps control your body. Okay, so those are the six special senses. Three of them are involved with the inner ear, and the others are in just special locations on different parts of your body. So let's start talking about the sense of smell, which officially is the sense of olfaction, the olfactory sense. All right, so in order for you to smell something, there has to be an airborne molecule called an odorant or an odor that binds to a receptor on nerves that are in your nasal cavity. And then that's going to initiate some electrical activity in neurons that we call action potentials in olfactory nerves that take action potentials to the brain, and in particular the olfactory cortex in the brain receives those signals in the temporal lobe, and when those signals reach the temporal lobe, you have the sensation of smell. But if those same signals went to some other part of the brain, you wouldn't have the sensation of smell. Right? It's only in the temporal lobe, in a particular part of the temporal lobe. And there are just a couple primary odors, right? And so here are some primary odors that we could think of: flowery, etheric, musky, camphorous, and some chemical compounds that elicit these kinds of sensations. And when you smell something, your brain breaks it down into each of these components and adds them together to figure out what kind of compound it is that's producing that smell. So these are the dimensions of smell. And smell is very complicated. We might actually have as many as 1,000 different kinds of receptor types and categories for smells. This is just a very basic understanding of how smell works. All right, so let's talk about some of the anatomy of the olfactory system. Anatomy. All right, so let's look at the slide on the right. Here we see a nice sagittal section. We see a nasal cavity, right? So here is the vestibule of the nose underneath this cartilage. And so air is inhaled past these nasal conchae. And here is the ethmoid bone. And there's a bunch of holes in the ethmoid bone, like the olfactory foramina, where the olfactory nerves poke through down into the nasal cavity. And this is the only place in your whole body where part of your nervous system is really sticking out from your body into just free space, but that's where they are, right here in the nose. There are receptors for odorant molecules on these nerves, so an odorant molecule has to enter the nose, and if you really want to smell something, what do you have to do to get those odorant molecules up here by the ethmoid bone in your nasal cavity? You actually have to go, right? You have to kind of sniff it up to get up in there. And those odorant molecules then will bind to these olfactory nerves, and then they will send signals to the brain via the olfactory tract. So let's look at these little zoomed in region right here. So here is the cribriform plate of the ethmoid bone. Here's an olfactory foramina. And here are the bipolar cells. These are the olfactory sensory neurons. And the receptors are on the cilia that poke off of the bipolar cells. And this is pretty much the only place where we have bipolar neurons, and that is in special senses. We don't have bipolar neurons anywhere else. Okay, and olfaction is one of the senses. So when an odorant molecule binds to this bipolar cell, it sends electrical impulses up to this mitral cell, and the mitral cell then sends action potentials to the brain, in particular the temporal lobe, so that you can experience the sense of smell. All right, so these cells, these bipolar cells, don't live very long because they're in kind of a rough environment. They're just, these processes are just hanging out in free space, maybe protected by a little bit of mucus, but that's not a whole lot of protection. It's not really inside your body. There are stem cells within this epithelium that can replace the bipolar cells. There are stem cells that can replace these neurons when they die. Maybe they're in a rough environment for whatever reason. Okay, and then there are support cells in this epithelium that try to maintain the health of these bipolar cells as well. So there's a number of different kinds of cells in this epithelium, including the sensory cells, the bipolar, the stem cells, and the basal cells. All right, so that's the sense of olfaction. The next sense that we're going to talk about is gustation. And gustation is the sense of taste. And again, a taste molecule has to dissolve in saliva, and it has to bind to a receptor on the tongue. So let's go look at some tongue pictures. Okay, so here we have a tongue. And if you look at your tongue in a mirror, you see that it's not just a flat, smooth surface. It's kind of velvety. It has a lot of little projections coming off of it. And a lot of people think that those things are taste buds, but they're not. They're just papillae, right? And the papillae then are lined with hundreds of taste buds. So let's take a look at the different kinds of papillae. On the anterior part of the tongue, we have some fungiform papillae. Kind of toward the posterior of the tongue, we've got some valate papillae. And then even way, way in the back, we've got some lingual papillae way back over here. And these produce different kinds of taste sensations. So let's zoom in to one of these papillae. And we can see some little structures that line a papillae. And so let's zoom into this structure right over here. And I see a number of different kinds of cells. I see a gustatory epithelial cell, and I see some basal cells, and I see on top of these gustatory epithelial cells some gustatory hairs or cilia projecting off the top. And on these cilia, they contain receptors for molecules. So an odorant, not an odorant, but a taste molecule has to dissolve in saliva, enter this taste pore, and bind to receptor on this gustatory hair, which then changes the electrical properties of this cell, which then sends signals to the brain via this nerve. Okay, so when you look at this, so this right here is a taste bud, and I might see about 20 cells that make up a taste bud. So how big is this taste bud? What do you see when you look at this taste bud right here? Do you see like a bone, like a femur, or what do you see? You just see some cells. What do you need to see a cell? How about your naked eye? Absolutely not. You need a microscope. So this taste bud right here is really a microscopic structure. A taste bud is something you can't see with your naked eye. You need a microscope in order to see it. All right, so you have hundreds of these taste buds lining each papillae. So don't confuse a papillae with a taste bud. They're much, much different. Okay, so we talked about all that. So the different taste sensations get to the brain via different pathways, sometimes on the facial nerve, sometimes on the glossopharyngeal nerve, sometimes on the vagus nerve, right? And then they enter the medulla, and then there's a second neuron that takes signals to the thalamus. And the thalamus, remember, is a relay station for distributing sensory information to the cerebral cortex. And then it goes to the gustatory cortex. That's kind of at the junction between a parietal lobe and temporal lobe. Sometimes we call that the insula right here. So this is, if we were to artificially stimulate this part of the brain of the cerebral cortex, then you would have a sensation of taste of some kind. We couldn't tell you exactly what it was, but it would be some kind of taste sensation. So what are some of the taste sensations? Would be sweet and sour, bitter. And there's another one called umami, which gives you the sense of fulfillment when you eat something, and that's usually due to amino acids that are in the food that you're eating. Right? And they're sometimes arranged by location, like sweet is on the tip of the tongue, bitter is going to be more toward the posterior of the tongue, and that's just all due to the kinds of receptors that those different kinds of molecules would bind to. All right, so that's it for taste. Vision. Let's move on to vision. Okay, because we're looking at that this week in lab. All right, so here's a pretty nice photograph of somebody's eye, and I see some eyebrows and eyelashes right here and eyelids. These are what we call accessory structures to vision. They don't actually allow you to see something, but they help protect the eye, right, from foreign bodies and from trauma. And so these eyelids right here is really what we call a palpebra. So here's the superior palpebra, here's the inferior palpebra, and the opening between them is the palpebral fissure. So palpebra is the name for, the official anatomic name for an eyelid. Eyelashes, we can call these eyelashes, no problem. Okay, the inside lining of an eyelid or a palpebra and the outside lining of this part of the eye is called a conjunctiva. It's a membrane, okay, and it helps moisten the eye, helps prevent infection, but it's just an epithelium that covers the eye. And there can be infection of the conjunctiva, and you call that, does anybody know what that's called? That's called conjunctivitis, right? And that's pretty easily treated. Okay. So here we have palpebra. So here is the globe of the eye. And attached to the globe of the eye, we see some of these red structures. And these are muscles. These are skeletal muscles. So that you have voluntary control of where this eyeball is going to be pointing and receiving light from. So you can look right, you can look left without turning your head. And we're going to see where that light ends up in just a little bit. So these are what we call extrinsic eye muscles because they're outside the eyeball. And there are six of them. Right, here's, and some of them are straight. Here's one that's straight. Here's one that's straight. And so we call these the rectus muscles. There are four rectus muscles. Here's a superior rectus. Here's an inferior rectus muscle. And then I'll show you how to name some of these others on the next slide. The white part of the eye is the outermost layer of the eye. That's called the sclera. And it's continuous with this clear part that's on the anterior pole of the eye. This is clear because it allows light to enter the eye. This is what we call the cornea. So the cornea is a specialized region of the sclera. The sclera is a tough layer. It helps shape the eye and protect the eye. But the cornea right here is a very delicate layer. And it has to be because it's clear to allow light rays to enter the eye so that you can see them. Okay. Okay, this is where we want to start. Your eye is moistened by a couple glands. One of the glands is the lacrimal gland. And so here you see the nose. The lacrimal gland is superior to the eye, but also lateral. So in lab, this is how you're going to be able to identify those extrinsic eye muscles. By looking for the lacrimal gland and knowing that it's superior and lateral on the eye, so then the lateral rectus will be over here, the medial rectus will be over here, and since the lacrimal gland is superior to the eye, then the superior rectus and inferior rectus are in these locations. All right, so the lacrimal gland produces tears that flow through these excretory ducts onto the eye, a superior part of the eye, and then gravity pulls it down over the eye, washing bacteria and viruses and fungi and other kinds of debris off the eye into this lacrimal punctum that's a little hole here and here. And this, the punctum leads to a canaliculus here and here, so tears flow into the canaliculus and down into the nasolacrimal duct, and then that empties into your nasal cavity. Okay, so that's how tears flow. So, for instance, if you're crying or something, shedding tears, that's how come you get a runny nose, because those tears run through these different structures to get into your nose, not just always down your face. All right, so so this is a way of protecting your eye from infection, right, because that washes these materials off of your eye, and they're also, they'll have some antibacterial properties as well, but they're not really true antibiotics. There's a nice mechanical function. Okay, so here is the eye once again, and we can see the rectus muscles. So here's the inferior rectus, here's the superior rectus. And on this slide right here, it'd probably be really hard for me to tell if this is a lateral or medial rectus, but from this diagram, okay, if the lacrimal gland was positioned right here, then I would know for sure this is the lateral rectus muscle, and here's the medial rectus muscle. The only other two that I haven't spoken about are ones that come in at an angle and attach themselves to the globe of the eye, and that is the superior oblique. Remember, oblique is not in a standard plane. It's on an angulated plane with respect to the rest of the body. So here's the superior oblique, and here is the inferior oblique. So these are all the six extrinsic eye muscles that are used for controlling where your eyeball is looking. Okay, let's look at this word slide right here. Yeah, we're getting down to layers of the eye. So here is a transverse section of the eye. So it's this kind of plane cut through the eye, looking from the top down into the eye. And let's talk about the layers of the eye first. The most superficial layer, this is the toughest layer. This is the sclera, contains a lot of connective tissue. It's not as hard as an eggshell, but it's probably tougher than an eggshell because it won't crack. It's like shoe leather. When you make an incision in lab, you'll see how tough it is. And then the next deepest layer is the choroid. The choroid has blood vessels in it, so it nourishes, it brings nutrients to the sclera and also to one other deeper layer of the eye right here. And this is where blood vessels should be, not so much in the sclera, because the sclera is there for protection and it shapes the eye. The third layer, the third deepest layer, is the retina. This is the layer that contains photoreceptor cells that can absorb light. And when those photoreceptor cells absorb light, they then can initiate electrical activity that goes to the brain. That electrical activity we call action potentials. And those action potentials go to the occipital lobe. So the primary visual cortex is the occipital lobe. If those action potentials went to the temporal lobe, then you would smell something, right? So your particular sense depends upon where these action potentials go. And for vision, they would go to the occipital lobe. All right, so no sclera, choroid, and retina. This right here is the optic nerve, cranial nerve number 3, and it attaches to the retina right in this location. And where it attaches, notice that there are some blood vessels here as well. It pushes the photoreceptor cells away. And it forms a disc on the retina that we call the optic disc. And since there are no photoreceptor cells in the optic disc, we also call it the blind spot. So in every eye, you have a blind spot, not quite at the posterior pole of the eye. So here's the anterior pole of the eye, and then going straight back is the posterior pole. So when we use our extrinsic eye muscles, we look at something so that the light shines right back on the posterior pole of the eye, and there's a special structure there that we're going to talk about in just a second, and it doesn't go to the optic disc, because if it went to the optic disc, you couldn't see it, right? And right now, you have two blind spots, one in one eye and one in the other, but your brain is erasing that information. It's getting information from one eye, filling in that blind spot, getting information from the other eye, filling in the blind spot in the other eye, so that day in and day out, we don't see it. We don't see the blind spot, but it is there. And in lab, if you want to see your blind spot, I'll put a diagram on the board, and a certain part of that diagram will just disappear when you get to the right distance, once you look at it in just the right way, with not both eyes, but with one eye. Okay, and as a matter of fact, you can close one eye and you'll see that this diagram will disappear, and then you open the other eye and it will reappear, which is kind of fascinating. We can do that little experiment in lab. Okay, so light comes in, goes right to the posterior pole of the eye, and this is the most sensitive region of the retina. We call this the macula lutea, and it has special cells there that give you high-resolution images and color images. Those kinds of cells are what we call cone cells. Cone cells are responsible for high acuity, high resolution, very sharp images that are in color. That's your best vision. And in the very center of the macula lutea, there's a little pit called the fovea centralis, and that has the highest concentration of 100% purely cone cells for your best vision. Okay, and as we move away, so this is your central vision spot. As we move away from the fovea centralis, the cones start to share the retina with another kind of cell called a rod cell. A rod cell is a little bit bigger, so it's more sensitive to light. It can see in dim light, but guess what? It can't work for color vision. It only works in shades of gray or black and white. And so that's a trade-off. The cone cells are good for color vision and very sharp vision, but you need bright light in order for them to work. The rod cells, which populate the retina in what we call the peripheral fields, okay, work in dim vision, but you can only see in black and white and in low resolution. So that's the trade-off with those. So maybe later on tonight you could go look up at the stars when the stars are out and find one that's sort of dim so that if you look right at it, the starlight is going to fall on the macula lutea or fovea centralis right here, and you won't be able to see it. But if you look to the side so that the starlight ends up on these peripheral cells in the retina, then that star kind of shows up again, but it's just going to look like a white spot, even though it might have a little bit of a blue color or red color to it, okay, if it was bright enough to see with the macula lutea. There's a degenerative disorder, unfortunately, of the macula lutea. Does anybody know what that degenerative disorder is called? It's called macular degeneration. Yeah, that's unfortunate when that happens to somebody. It can happen for a whole number of different reasons. And when that happens, then somebody develops a blind spot right in their central vision, which is their best vision, unfortunately. So it would be like taking your fingertip and putting it right in front of your eyeball, both eyeballs, and that's what your vision would be like. So you could see on the periphery, but you couldn't see what you're looking at directly. Okay, that's too bad when that happens. Right, macular degeneration. And maybe sometimes that's due to blood vessels that grow up into the macula lutea. Right, so where should blood vessels be? In the choroid right here, not in the retina, because if they grow into the retina, then they push the photoreceptor cells away. Sometimes we call that angiogenesis, when a blood vessel starts to grow in a certain part of your body. If they grow into the macula lutea, then you have nice blood vessels there, but no photoreceptor cells, which then means that you're blind in that one particular region. All right, so that's the importance of this, the choroid, right? These blood vessels shouldn't grow up into the retina. It happens in another condition as well. We didn't know about for a long time. Okay, when a baby is born prematurely, sometimes they have to be put into a special environment. Anybody know what that little special environment is? Yeah, an incubator. And in that environment, because that newborn baby's lungs haven't developed because they're preterm, they need a higher oxygen content. So the oxygen content is boosted up so that they have an easier time breathing. But that oxygen in an incubator can dissolve through the cornea right here and move through this chamber of the eye and even into the retina and into the choroid, and it stimulates the growth of blood vessels from the choroid into the retina when that happens. Okay? And when those blood vessels develop in the retina, then that infant develops severe vision deficits because they don't have photoreceptor cells where those blood vessels are. And that's called a retinopathy of prematurity. And nowadays, right, we know that's happening, so that's always an important clinical guess, right, or decision a clinician has to make, and that is, how should we adjust that oxygen level to maintain the health and life of that baby without promoting the growth of blood vessels from the choroid into the retina? It's not a necessarily easy decision that always is made. And people didn't realize that for years, and then it took a while, right? Then these people grew up and had vision deficits, and finally somebody figured out why they got vision deficits, and that's because of the oxygen content that was used in the incubators. All right, so what kind of cells do you have in the retina right here, or what kind of tissue? Not blood vessels, but photoreceptor cells. And you got two kinds. You got rods and cones, and the cones are good for high acuity color vision, but they only work in bright light. The rod cells work in dim light, but what do you see with a rod cell? Only black and white vision, and not very fine detail either. Okay, so that's the trade-off. Okay, this cavity inside the eye helps hold the retina in place, and we call this the posterior segment of the eye. And the posterior segment of the eye contains a substance that we call vitreous humor. It's sort of like a solution of stuff, but it's more like a jello. It's more like a jelly, right? And it helps hold the retina up against the choroid. That's part of its job. And remember, the retina, all of these are living cells, and they need to be very close to these blood vessels to get oxygen and glucose and other kinds of nutrients and to get rid of waste products. All right, so if the retina ever separates from the choroid right here, then that part of the retina is going to die, and you'll have a vision deficit in that part of your visual field as well. And that's usually due to, for instance, head trauma. You get into a car accident, motorcycle accident, or even if you play sports and you experience head trauma, which is kind of common for boxers, professional boxers, to have a detached retina from the choroid. And it actually happened to a real famous boxer who was really good, hardly ever got hit in the head, and he didn't tell anybody that he had a detached retina in one of his eyes, in one little location, Because if that news got out, what would happen? Well, then whoever he was competing against would go to that visual field and attack him from that angle, and he couldn't see what would be coming from that particular direction. Okay? Does anybody know who that was? He was told by his doctors never to get in the ring again because he could lose all of his vision in that eye. That was Sugar Ray Leonard. But he was so good, hardly anybody ever hit him in the head. And so he decided, well, it was much better to earn tens of millions of dollars and risk losing your vision than stop boxing. Okay, so you got that vitreous humor in the posterior segment of the eye. When we move from that posterior segment, we bump into the lens. Here's the lens, kind of a complicated little contraption because it has some other structures associated with it. It has some ligaments, suspensory ligaments, and on the other side of the suspensory ligaments, we have something that's labeled a ciliary body, and the ciliary body is actually a muscle. And so that muscle can contract and relax, and it changes the tension on these suspensory ligaments, so it can pull or it can relax tension on the lens, and when it does, it changes the shape of the lens. It can make the lens real flat, and when the tension goes away, because of the elastic properties of a lens, it gets a lot shorter, but then it kind of puckers up like that, and it has more curvature. And as the lens has more curvature, then it can bend light to a greater degree so that it focuses on the retina. And it just so happens, when something is close to the eye, within about 20 feet and closer, the light rays are bending away from the eye very drastically, so the lens has to have a lot of curvature to get it to focus, to get those light rays to bend back and focus, so it's a nice sharp image on the retina. So when you're looking at something close, the lens has to have a lot of curvature. When you're looking at something far away, the light rays are coming in all mostly parallel. They're not diverging very much, so it doesn't take a lot of curvature to get them to focus back on the lens, on the retina here, sorry, back on the retina. All right, so this lens is changing all the time because of the muscle, the ciliary body is changing tension on these suspensory ligaments. That process, you got to know the name of that process, that's called accommodation. All right, and that's important because we could do a little experiment. We could take your fingernail, okay, on your fingertip, just leave it on your fingertip, but move your fingertip way out in front of you like this at arm's length, and you can use one eye or both eyes, it doesn't really matter. Use both eyes and focus really hard on your fingernail. Concentrate on your fingernail, so that's it when the fingernail is in focus. When the fingernail is in focus, what about the background? It's blurry, right? It's out of focus. Okay, now keep your fingernail there and focus on something behind your fingernail, like in the background. What happened to your fingernail? Now it's out of focus. So you can only focus at one distance from your eyeball at a time, not both. And that's just a physical reality of how all lenses work. All cameras are that way. Movie cameras and film directors use that technique all the time to focus on different parts of a scene that are happening at different times. Okay. So that process is called accommodation. In order for you to change where you're focusing, right, the lens actually has to change shape due to this muscle, the ciliary body that's pulling on these suspensory ligaments right here. One of the unfortunate things about getting older, okay, is that the lens gets stiffer as you get older. So it doesn't like to change shape quite so much. And you might have trouble or you might have difficulty actually making the lens bend enough to see things up close. And in that particular case, then what do you need? You need some reading glasses, right, to help do the job that the lens no longer does. Plus, it also takes longer for the lens to change its shape because it's just stiffer as it gets older. Okay, so that's why when you see, like, somebody really old on the freeway, what do you do with somebody that's driving on the freeway that's really old, like 65, 70 years old? You just kind of get out of their way, right? They're driving really slow. They're probably driving like 40 miles an hour. Right, and you're thinking, oh man, why is that person even on the freeway? Okay, well let's kind of consider what they're going through. Okay, because their lens is real stiff. They have difficulty accommodating, and it takes a long time for them to accommodate. So they're sitting in their car, and if you're 65 years old, or 70 years old, and you're still driving, what is one thing that you're really worried about? Speeding, getting any kind of ticket because you might lose your license, right? And then you'll lose your independence driving around. So you don't ever want to speed and get a ticket. So that's one of the reasons why they drive so slow, because when they're driving, they're not looking down the road, they're looking at the speedometer to make sure that they're not speeding so they don't get a speeding ticket. Right? So you look at the speedometer and you go, oh, I'm going 35 miles an hour in the 70 zone. Okay, I'm not speeding. You're really excited. But then what are you worried about all of a sudden? Well, you're not watching where you're going, right? So you're really satisfied that you're not speeding. So you look up from the speedometer, which is right in front of your face, and you look down the road, and what do you see? It's all blurry because you haven't accommodated yet. So you look down and you go, well, wow, I don't want to miss my exit because I don't really like being on the freeway because all these traffic is going past me real fast. So you look down the freeway, 1001, 1002, and then all of a sudden, okay, you can see down the road and you can see your exit is still down the road. You haven't missed your exit, and so you're kind of feeling relieved again. Ah, but then what happens to you? Well, I might be speeding. Ow. So then you stop looking down the road. You look at the speedometer. It's up close, and you have to accommodate. So you look at the speedometer, and what does it look like? It's all blurry. 1001, 1002. It pops into focus, and you go, ah, oh, it's great. I'm not speeding. But then what are you worried about? You don't want to miss your exit. All right. So anyway, when you see those viejitos out there, just be really gentle and kind with them because they just don't see as well as all of us, right? So just give them a lot of room and don't hassle them, okay? Because that's going to happen to all of us one of these days. So that's accommodation. The lens has to change shape, right? Okay, there's some other things that are important for vision, and that is light intensity changes. Sometimes it's very bright outside. If we were to walk out when the sun is outside, it's kind of dim in the room, so our eyes should be able to see things under different lighting conditions. And there's something right here called the iris that can make changes in how light enters the eye. It can adjust for the light intensity so that our vision pretty much stays constant. All right, so the iris is a muscle. It's a pigmented muscle, so that means that it has pigments, means that it can absorb light. It can prevent light from entering the eye. And there's a hole. What do we call a hole in anatomy? A hole in a structure. A foramen. So there's a foramen in the iris. And what's the function of a foramen? It's a passageway. And in this particular case, it's a passageway for light. That foramen is called the pupil. And when you look at somebody's pupil, it looks absolutely black because light doesn't bounce off of it. Light actually enters the eye and kind of disappears. And that's why it looks black. All right, so the pupil is the hole in the iris. When the iris constricts, the pupil gets really small. When the iris relaxes, the pupil gets really big and allows a lot of light to enter. So probably everybody's pupil in here right now, since it's dim light, is dilated. You have big pupils. If we were to step outside, then the iris would constrict and the pupil would get really small, and that helps protect the retina from damage of having too much light enter the eye. All right, so notice that the lens is changing shape all the time, depending on where you're looking. And notice that the iris is changing shape all the time, depending on lighting conditions. So there's a lot of motion inside the eye. There is another segment or another cavity in the eye that is anterior to the lens, right? We call this the posterior segment that's posterior to the lens. Here is the lens. This is what we call the anterior cavity. It does not have vitreous humor, but it has aqueous humor. It has a watery fluid in it. And what can you tell me about water? It likes to flow from one place to another. It's very runny, as opposed to like jelly, which is kind of sticky. All right, so you have aqueous humor in this region right here. This particular space between the iris and the lens, this is what we call the anterior cavity of the anterior segment of the eye. Anterior to the iris, this is what we call the anterior cavity of the anterior segment of the eye. Right, so here's the anterior cavity. Here's the posterior cavity of the anterior segment. The posterior segment of the eye doesn't have subcavities to it. It just contains vitreous humor. Okay, so between the iris and the specially modified part of the sclera that we call the cornea, which is absolutely clear, this is the anterior cavity of the anterior segment of the eye, and it contains aqueous humor. So the cornea is not really tough like the sclera. It's not really tough like the sclera. It's pretty delicate, and it's innervated with a lot of nerve fibers. So any damage to the cornea will produce a lot of pain. As a matter of fact, I've been told that if that cornea is damaged, that will give you the most exquisite sense of pain that you can experience. So you want to protect your corneas. That's why we have you wear goggles and protective eyewear in labs, whether it's a physics lab or chemistry lab or biology lab when you're doing dissections, to protect your corneas. Okay? Not only will it be painful, but it will damage the cornea. So for instance, let's consider this. Maybe you're putting together a bicycle for your kids or a swing set or something, and a metal piece breaks off of a wrench, maybe a screw fractures or something, and it runs, maybe you're hammering a nail that breaks, and that piece of metal goes up against the cornea and puts a hole in the cornea. Okay? It's going to feel really, really bad, but that's not really the bad thing. Okay? Do you want to know what the bad thing is that happens? Right, when there's a hole in the cornea, then that fluid that fills this anterior segment right here, since it's aqueous humor, can just run right out of the eye, like tears. Right? So that fluid runs out of the eye, and now the cornea can bump up against the iris. And now the iris can bump up against the lens, because there's no fluid separating these different structures in the eye. And the really terrible thing is that these structures are sticky, and no one has ever figured out a way how to unstick a lens from an iris once it gets stuck to it. And no one has ever figured out a way how to unstick a cornea from an iris or a cornea from a lens when it pokes through the pupil right here. All right, so what does that do for somebody? Well, what can you tell me about the lens and the iris? What are they doing all day long? They should be moving. Right? They're changing shape all the time and independent of each other, depending on where you're looking or what the lighting conditions are. But if they're glued together, guess what happens? They can't move anymore. And so somebody has really severe vision deficits as a result of that. So it's really important to protect this cornea to make sure that that aqueous humor stays right in this anterior segment so that these different tissues never touch each other inside the eye. Okay? Okay. Something else about this aqueous humor right here, it's produced by this region of the ciliary body, and sometimes this region produces too much aqueous humor, and it flows out the pupil, and usually it gets resorbed by this scleral venous sinus right here, that fluid then gets returned to the cardiovascular system. But sometimes maybe there's an occlusion in the sinus, so fluid builds up in this chamber right here, we call this the anterior segment, right? Too high a pressure, and that puts pressure on the vitreous humor, and that puts pressure on the retina, which puts pressure on the choroid, which then reduces the amount of blood flow into the choroid, which then, since there's not sufficient blood flow through the choroid, it damages the retina. And when the retina is damaged, what happens to your vision? It starts to go away. Okay, so that produces a retinopathy. So high pressure in this anterior segment, right, can produce blindness. Does anybody know what that condition is called? Probably. That's called glaucoma. Right, and it's recommended that people get checked for glaucoma once a year, every 12 months. Okay, because that if you have glaucoma, that's going to result in blindness in that eye. All right, so every time you get your eyes checked for a prescription for glasses, they always do that glaucoma test to check for pressures in this anterior segment of the eye. Okay, what else do I want to say about the eye right here? Just make sure that you know what the layers are, what the two major cavities are, what the subcavities of the anterior segment are, what accommodation is, right, which is the changing the shape of the lens. Oh, there is something else I want to say. Okay. So I see that the lens has curvature so that it can take light that's diverging from wherever it's originating from and get it focused back to a point on the retina so it looks nice and sharp. All right, so I see some curvature. But you see some other curvature that sort of looks like a lens that light has to pass through before it gets to the retina. What is the first thing that light has to pass through before it enters the eye? It's the cornea. And look at the cornea. Is it flat? Absolutely not. It has curvature as well. So the cornea is acting as a lens as well. As a matter of fact, it's even more important than the lens inside your eye. It has more focusing power than the lens. So the job of the lens is really for accommodation so that you can see things up close or far away, but not at the same time. But the job of the cornea right here is to do the major focusing of light so that you can see things clearly. So the cornea and the lens together work together to make sure that you see a sharp image. And so that's why on the word slide that I have right here, I have an asterisk on the cornea, and I have an asterisk on the lens, meaning that these things work together to form a clear visual image on the retina. So it's not only the shape of the lens that allows you to see things clearly, but it's also the shape of the cornea. And that's kind of handy. Some people take advantage of that with a procedure called a LASIK procedure. Because maybe their eyeball is too long, so that light focuses in front of the retina, and that will give them blurry vision. And so what happens is then a physician can change the shape of the cornea with a laser by burning away a couple cells of the cornea right here. The cornea then changes shape, and the light isn't bent quite so much, and now it's focusing on the retina, and you have near perfect or even better than normal vision when that happens. Okay, that's called a LASIK procedure. All right, I don't really recommend doing that for cosmetic reasons. Some people get a LASIK procedure because they don't like glasses. But I'm trying to convince you that you should like glasses. Why is it a good idea to wear glasses? Because it protects your cornea day in and day out, right? From puncture and from chemical burns and things like that. Okay? So that's why I like to wear glasses. And I don't have a LASIK procedure. But the other thing is, what can you tell me about your vision through your life? Is it the same day in and day out? No, it changes. And that LASIK procedure will make that correction for that one time when a doctor measures the distance, right, from your retina to your lens over here. So even though you get a LASIK procedure, it might work fine on that day, but maybe not a year or 2 years down the road. And it used to be that you couldn't get the LASIK procedure redone or readjusted, but now I think they can do it maybe one or maybe even two times later on in your life to give you good vision. All right, but you're always messing with your vision. All right, and what did we say? What happens to you when you get older? What happens to this lens right here? It stops changing shape, right? So you have difficulty reading things up close, and so you need reading glasses. So when somebody gets a LASIK procedure and it changes the shape of their cornea, I've had a lot of friends get a LASIK procedure, and after about a half a second, they have near perfect vision, and they walk outside, and they're just amazed at how clear their vision is without glasses. And they get a phone call on their cell phone and get their cell phone out of their pocket and try to answer the cell phone or to make a phone call, and guess what? They can't use their cell phone because they can't see it, because their vision now has been optimized for far away at the expense of near vision. All right, and so what somebody has traded would be the use of far away glasses for now they have to have reading glasses to read. Right, and that just happened in an instant of a second when they got that LASIK procedure. So there's a trade-off between far vision and near vision. So make sure if you get a LASIK procedure, you talk to a physician who's reputable that will tell you all this stuff that will happen to you, okay, and make up your mind. So I don't really recommend LASIK for cosmetic reasons, but for instance, if you're a professional athlete, maybe a basketball player or a boxer, well, you don't want to go into the boxing ring with a pair of glasses on, then a LASIK procedure is great for you, right? You can earn millions of dollars and you don't have to worry about losing your vision. Or if your vision is so poor to where when you wake up in the morning you can't even find your glasses, then a LASIK procedure is great. It will change your life as well, but not for kind of superficial, sort of silly reasons because you don't like the way glasses look. It's probably not a really good reason in my understanding for the LASIK procedure. Okay, but LASIK procedure is great because we don't have to surgerize anything that's interior to the eye, only this outermost layer. So it's a relatively easy, relatively safe, but mistakes can happen. And if a mistake happens, what's gonna be hurt? Your vision. So I'm uncomfortable with that procedure. All right, so that's the eyeball. The eyeball has these different layers. Sometimes a layer we call a tunic or a coat. Okay, the fibrous tunic is made up of the sclera and the cornea. And the cornea really is just a modified part of the sclera and this venous sinus right here. The vascular tunic we find in the choroid. Okay, and that also includes the iris and the ciliary body. It has a blood supply because there are muscles in there. And then the sensory tunic is in the retina. So that's maybe a good way to think of these different tunics. There's a neural layer that has those photoreceptor cells in it. And what were the names of those photoreceptor cells once again? Yeah, rods and cones. And then there's also a pigmented layer with melanocytes. Have you ever heard of a melanocyte before? Yeah. Okay, melanocyte absorbs light. It's a pigment that absorbs light so that when light goes through the retina, it's absorbed by these melanocytes so that light doesn't bounce around inside your eye, and that would cause flashes of light. Some animals actually use that to increase their sensitivity to light at night. In the choroid, they have some pigments that are very silvery. It's called a tapetum lucidum. Like cats and dogs have this layer, so light goes in, passes through the retina, hits that layer, bounces back out. So they like see twice the amount of light under dim conditions. And maybe you're familiar with that. Have you ever shined a flashlight on a cat or something or dog when it's really dark out? It's like you can see the light beams coming right out of their eyes. Kind of, they look like a demon or something. But it's not anything bad like that. It's just that they have a specially modified choroid called a tapetum lucidum that reflects light back out, and that can excite the retina, stimulate the retina once again so they can see under very dim conditions, better than what we can see. Okay, so the visual pathways, the photoreceptor cells are rods and cones, and then these are connected up to bipolar cells. All right, so here I see some of these nice bipolar cells. Here are the rod cells, and here's a cone cell. Cone cell is kind of smaller, so it's not as sensitive. It needs more light to be excited, but that also means it can see in much better detail than a much thicker kind of rod cell. All right, and the cones are in your central vision. Rods are in your peripheral vision. These will change the electrical properties of this bipolar cell, which then will stimulate these ganglion cells, which send action potentials to the brain. And the part of the brain that receives those action potentials is the occipital lobe. So the occipital lobe is the primary visual cortex. So if we were to artificially stimulate the occipital lobe, and you should know where that occipital lobe is, electrically or chemically, if we were to stimulate the cells of the occipital lobe, what would you experience? Would some part of your body move? Or would you have a sensation? Or would you smell something or taste something? Or what would happen to you? Since it's your primary visual cortex, you would have some kind of visual experience. You would see something. It wouldn't be like seeing anything that you're used to seeing because it's not ordered, but you would have some kind of visual experience, and maybe we could call that a hallucination, except the hallucination is produced by no stimulus whatsoever. At least in this particular case, we did have a stimulus applied to the occipital lobe. Okay. So, let's see if I can find how these signals enter the... Oh, here's a really nice picture of a retina. Here is where the optic nerve attaches. It's off to the side a little bit. That produces a blind spot. That's the optic disc. That's where the optic nerve attaches to the retina. And this right here is the macula lutea. And the very center of the macula lutea is the fovea centralis. In this region, you have mostly cone cells, and then those give way to rod cells that you have in peripheral vision over here. And this looks like a nice, normal retina to me. With other kinds of disease processes, then we're going to find holes or spots on the retina. Those would be retinopathies, most commonly produced by hypertension, high blood pressure, and also diabetes can destroy the retina. Okay, so that's why it's really good if you have hypertension or a family member with hypertension to make sure they're compliant with their medication to control it. And the same thing for diabetes as well, which then helps, they have to control their blood sugar. The retina is very sensitive to those two conditions. Okay, here you see the flow of aqueous humor being produced by the ciliary processes of the ciliary body flowing through this posterior segment of the posterior cavity of the anterior segment of the eye, out the pupil, into this anterior chamber of the anterior segment of the eye, and then being resorbed by the scleral venous sinus. And if there's a disruption in this flow, and high pressure develops in this area, that's what we call glaucoma. All right, well, let me go to the folder to find the slide that I'm looking for. Okay, so here we see two eyes, and we see a visual field on the left and a visual field on the right. The field on the right is in a yellow color. Okay, and the field on the left is in a blue. How did I do? Good, I did good. Okay, so yellow and blue. All right, so the information from the right visual field, right, goes to either the left, well, it goes to the left visual field on this eyeball because it's coming in from the right, right, so it bends into the eye. And so this contains those ganglion axons from the ganglion cells bringing information to the central nervous system. So this is what we call the optic nerve. The optic nerve is carrying information from both visual fields from one eyeball. Here's the optic nerve on the other side, and it's carrying information from what, both visual fields, but just over in this one eyeball. And then it gets right to the entrance of the central nervous system, and some of these fibers cross over. Right, so this is what we call the optic chiasma, right where the optic nerves cross over. And remember, where do we find a nerve? In the central nervous system or peripheral nervous system? Peripheral nervous system. All right, so the optic nerve is in the peripheral nervous system. It enters the central nervous system right here at the optic chiasma. These axons proceed inside the central nervous system, but we don't have any nerves inside the central nervous system. What do we call these pathways in the central nervous system? A tract. All right, so here is the optic tract. So here is the optic nerve. There's where things cross over at the optic chiasm. And as these signals proceed, now they're in the central nervous system, so this is no longer a nerve, even though they're the exact same cells. We call this the optic tract. So you got optic nerve, optic chiasma, optic tract. So notice that the information that's received from the right visual field, from the right eye and left eye, okay, the right visual field, where does that go? Some of it crosses over from the right eye and it goes to the left side of the occipital lobe. Information from the left visual field crosses over and it goes to the right visual cortex. All right, so these signals do cross over, and in lab I want you to make sure you know where this optic chiasma is. Right, and this is where some of the information passes over, or crosses over right here. Okay. All right, so that takes us to hearing, and actually all the parts of the ear. So let's look at all the parts of the ear right here. And some of it is highlighted. It's not really zoomed in. It's sort of drawn to scale. All right, and the ear has three main parts. There's an external, a middle, and an internal ear. Sometimes we call the inner ear a labyrinth. There are bony structures within the labyrinth. There are three main structures that make up a labyrinth, and these bony structures are inside the temporal bone, and in particular, a specific region of the temporal bone. It's a region between the external acoustic meatus and the internal acoustic meatus. Anybody remember what that region is called? Between these two things, it's called the petrous region of the temporal bone. So there are bones inside the temporal bone, which we call the labyrinth. Okay, we're going to talk about those senses in a little bit. The middle ear is right in this region right here, and it has bones as well. And it's kind of contained within the temporal bone, but it's really outside the inner ear. There are three auditory ossicles, and anytime you hear that word osteo or ossicle, you should think of bone. These little bones are really small. Here's the malleus, incus, and stapes. And all three would fit between my fingertips, just like that, and you couldn't see them. That's how small they are. But they're important because they take sound energy, sound vibrations, from the external ear and transmit them to the inner ear. So these bones actually vibrate back and forth. And they help amplify the sound that's received by the tympanic membrane. So when a sound wave enters, it vibrates the tympanic membrane back and forth, it vibrates the auditory ossicles, and the stapes then pushes on a membrane on the vestibule that introduces that sound wave to the watery environment of the cochlea. And sound really doesn't like to enter water. And one way to think of that is, maybe we're having a conversation and we're at your house and you have a nice pool, okay, and I'm standing on the deck of the pool and you're in the pool and you're tired of listening to me talk anatomy, so what can you do? You can go underwater, okay? So you dive underwater and I'm still talking, but can you hear me? Not really well, because sound doesn't like to go into water just because of the physical properties of air and water are different. All right. So there's water in this cochlea here, even though you're not underwater right now, but sound has difficulty getting into the cochlea. So that's why the tympanic membrane is really large. It vibrates a lot. Right, and here's a little mechanical lever system that produces very large amplitude waves, which then presses on a small membrane underneath the stapes. Right, so the surface area of this membrane, which we call the oval window, is relatively small, so it has to move back and forth a lot, and that helps introduce those sound waves into the watery environment of your inner ear right here, so that you can even hear, right, when you're just in air. All right, so it's the surface area, the tympanic membrane to the oval window that allows you to hear with the cochlea. And it's also the job of these ossicles to amplify the sound so that the energy can enter the cochlea. All right, sound waves bounce off the tympanic membrane because they enter the external acoustic meatus. Right, and then there are some cartilaginous structures that help focus sound waves into the external acoustic meatus, and we call this the auricle of the ear, or the pinna of the ear, or pinna of the ear. All right, so those are the three parts of the ear that you should know: external, middle, and internal. Now, this tympanic membrane, in order for you to hear something, has to be able to vibrate back and forth, so that if this middle ear is filled with fluid, or maybe bacteria, this tympanic membrane can't vibrate because that material is going to push on the tympanic membrane. And if the tympanic membrane can't vibrate, then guess what? You really can't hear anything. Your ears are kind of plugged up. Or if there's high pressure in this middle ear right here, maybe you were up in the mountains and you come down out of the mountains and now you're at sea level and there's high pressure in the air, it's going to press on the tympanic membrane, is going to press it into the middle ear, and again, it can't vibrate. You'll have difficulty hearing until maybe you yawn or sneeze or chew gum or something, and then all of a sudden you might hear a little hissing sound, and then all of a sudden you can hear once again normally. So what's happening there? Because there's a special little tube that connects the middle ear to your throat, and I see it right here. It's got three names. Right, you could use either one of these names in lab, it doesn't matter. Sometimes it's called the Eustachian tube, sometimes it's called the auditory tube, and sometimes it's called the pharyngotympanic tube. And I like pharyngotympanic because it tells you what the origin and destination of this tube is. The origin is the pharynx. And you're going to learn here that the pharynx is just a scientific name for your throat. Okay, that's on the back of your mouth. Your throat, and tympanic means near the tympanic membrane. So here's a tube that is actually connected to the outside world. And when you pass air through this tympanic, pharyngotympanic tube, it equalizes the pressure on either side of the tympanic membrane, and so that it can vibrate more freely, and that increases your sensitivity to sound. So sometimes when you're going up in an airplane, you have to clear your middle ear by maybe pressurizing your nose, right, or swallowing or chewing gum or something like that, and then all of a sudden you can hear much better. Or maybe when you're descending in an airplane, you have to go through the same kind of procedure to clear your ears. Or that's what happens when you're scuba diving, to equalize the pressure on either side of your ear. One unfortunate thing is that little kids are prone to get middle ear infections. So it's called otitis media. When they get a middle ear infection, then this pharyngotympanic tube, or even if they have allergies, or if you have an allergy or a cold, this pharyngotympanic tube becomes obstructed and you can't clear your middle ear, so that when you're taking off in an airplane, that pushes the tympanic membrane, and it's very painful because you can't clear your ear. Right? And like I said, that happens a lot to little kids, so a lot of times little kids are kind of unruly in an airplane because they're experiencing a lot of pain in their ears because they have otitis media. Sometimes a physician might prescribe an antihistamine, okay, to reduce the inflammation in this area here so that an adult or maybe even a child will have an easier time clearing their ears when they're going cross country on an airplane flight. All right, so just be aware again, if a kid is really misbehaving on an airplane, it's not maybe because of his nature, or maybe not because the parents aren't teaching them how to behave in public. It might be because they're experiencing severe pain due to not being able to clear their middle ear. Okay, so this labyrinth right here is responsible for three senses. This thing that looks like a snail is called the cochlea. That's a bony labyrinth, and that's responsible for hearing. This bulge right here is part of a bony labyrinth for another sense, the sense for linear acceleration. We call that static equilibrium. And then these, right here, there are three of them. I only see two on this diagram. These are what we call semicircular canals, and they give you the sense for angular acceleration or spinning in space. So linear is just a straight line change in velocity. Angular acceleration is when you're changing the rate at which you're spinning. So the semicircular canals are the bony labyrinth that allow you to experience spinning so that you don't lose your balance. There's some little bulges right here at the base of each of the circular canals. That's called an ampule. And an ampule, the reason why it's named an ampule is because sometimes you might have a little glass vial that contains medication, maybe a serum, or it could even contain dry powder that you have to rehydrate before it's injected into somebody, so you can stick a little needle into this vial. That vial is called an ampule. Right? And that reminded whoever did this couple initial dissections of this inner ear, that reminded them of a little ampule, so they call this the ampule of the semicircular canals. And there's some special organs in these ampules that allow you to detect spinning. Okay, there are some muscles in the inner ear that protect you from high decibels or from very, very loud sounds. Okay, and I see one of them right here, the tensor tympani and the stapedius muscle. So maybe you're in your car. I know this happens to me when I loan my car out to my wild nephews. They drive around town with the stereo playing really loud, and I get in the car first thing in the morning, and the stereo's blasting. And I go, how could anybody listen to that? Okay, and that's because, and maybe, yeah, I didn't even give my nephews the car that evening, but it happens, right? And that's because when you're listening to the stereo, these muscles start to contract, and it dampens the sound. And so what do you do to your stereo? Can't quite hear it as much, so you turn it up a little bit. So then these muscles contract a little bit more to protect your ear, and what do? Turn the volume up on the stereo, right? Keep turning it up. So these muscles help protect your inner ear from high-intensity sound waves. You got the tensor tympani right here and the stapedius. And then you can see the three auditory ossicles in the middle chamber of the ear, the malleus, the incus, and the stapes. Okay. So here is the oval window. That's how sound energy enters the inner ear. And that sound energy rolls around through this cochlea. We're going to talk about that next time. But it has to have a way to escape. If all that energy entered the cochlea without escaping, then that would damage the cochlea. That could even fracture the bone. All right, so sound energy rolls around through the cochlea and it leaves through the round window. All right, so sound energy enters via the oval window, and it leaves via the round window right here. So that's something else that you should be aware of. Okay, the sign-in sheet is going around somewhere. We got to finish up just a couple things with hearing next time, and we'll move on to the next chapter.